Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, every now and then in science, a discovery comes along that makes possible a big leap forward in our understanding of something in nature, or that confirms a theory that was generally accepted but never actually proven. That's true in the physical sciences, like chemistry or physics or biology, but it's also true in the more observational sciences, let's call them, like archaeology or psychology or anthropology. So, you're all familiar, I think, with the theory that the native peoples of North and South America originally came across a land bridge that existed thousands of years ago, linking Siberia with Alaska across what is now the Bering Sea. But at the time, there was land that people could walk across, and the theory is that they came across from west to east, and that's how Native Americans came to North and South America. But there were still questions about this theory, and my guest is a forensic anthropologist with a company called Applied Paleoscience, located in Bothell, Washington. His name is Dr. James Chatters. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Can I call you Jim?
Yes, please.
That's good. If I couldn't, we'd have to end the show right here. Anyway, so Jim was the lead researcher into a discovery in Mexico that has now proven that long-held theory of the land bridge. So, Jim, first, can you summarize the land bridge theory for us, just kind of briefly?
Well, the idea based on the similarities between Native Americans and people of Northeast Asia has, for over 100 years, been that Native Americans' ancestors came across a connection between Alaska and Siberia back during the Pleistocene, during the last ice age. And genetics have generally supported that idea. The genetic markers in the American populations are only found in East Asia, or almost all of them are found in East Asia or Central Asia. So that seemed to support that idea based on modern people.
So why did we think that there was a land bridge there then, which is not obviously not there now?
When there were tremendous masses of ice on the land during glacial times, sea level dropped and exposed the continental shelves. And there's a huge land connection. It's a minimum of 1,000 miles wide where Siberia and Alaska meet. So people could easily have lived on that land mass, and we think they did in an area we refer to as Beringia.
How long ago was this?
At the height of the glaciation, which is 26,000 to 18,000 years ago, that's when people are thought to have moved first into Beringia.
So was it really covered with ice, or was there land at some points along this bridge that they could walk along without having to clamber across a glacier?
No, Beringia was pretty much ice-free. There's no high ground there. The glaciers are coming off the mountains in Alaska and the mountains in Siberia. But Beringia itself, the lowland area, would have been ice-free back then.
So the sea level rose after that and covered up the land, and then the land bridge disappeared and the continent separated, but the people on the other side were stranded.
Right. By 10,000 years ago, land connection ceased to exist. People still went back and forth with boats, but the easy flow of people back and forth was over by 10,000 years ago.
So now, tell us about the discovery in Mexico that I mentioned in the introduction that kind of led to your study that produced this groundbreaking result. What happened?
Well, cave divers have been exploring the underwater caves of the Yucatan Peninsula for more than 20 years. And a group from Tulum back in 2007 was mapping one tunnel set called Outland Cave and came upon an immense pit inside the cave, deep inside the cave, more than 2,000 feet from the nearest entrance. And because it swallowed up the light, they called it the Black Hole or Hoyo Negro. And when they came back 2 months later and explored the bottom, they found bones of large animals, and the large animal bones drew them to one area. And there, one of the divers, Alex Alvarez, found the skull of the human we call Naya.
And Naya is a, what? I think I read she's a teenage girl.
Right. right. And I as a teenage girl, I'm 15 or 16 years old, very small, only about 4'10", and very, very slender. So it's just a little, little tiny person.
So this cave, the divers obviously were diving in a cave that was full of water, but if they were 2,000 and more feet into it, Naya didn't swim in there herself. Was the cave still full of water at that time, and did she, her body drift in there, or was it dry at the time?
At the time Naya went in, she walked in dry tunnels and would have been either in there at the hole trying to get water out, because there was an ephemeral pool, a temporary pool of water in the bottom of that deep hole. The hole itself goes as much as 150 feet below sea level.
Wow.
And so she was at 40 feet, so she had a long distance drop, actually more like 190 feet below sea level is the deepest part of the cave. So if she was getting water, she may have fallen in doing that, or she may have been in the cave for some other reason and gotten lost in the dark and just stepped off an edge.
So again, how long ago do they think this was that she was in the cave and died?
Well, we ran a series of both radiocarbon and uranium-thorium dates to narrow down the time when she died, but she died between 12 and 13,000 years ago.
Okay, so around the time that the people were posited to be, speculated to be coming across the Beringian land bridge from Asia to North America, or at least sometime after that time, but in that general period.
Right, the earliest substantiated, I think well substantiated archaeological sites in North and South America date to a little over 14,000 years ago. So perhaps sometime shortly after 15,000 years ago, people first entered the Americas. So she's one of the earliest ones we know of.
So what was it about this particular skull that they found down in the bottom of this water-filled cave that was so crucial to proving the land bridge theory? I mentioned it was like a groundbreaking discovery. I assume other skeletons and skulls have been found, but what was it about this particular skull that was kind of the key thing to proving the theory?
The unique thing about this case is that in Naya we have both her complete, well-preserved skeleton, particularly her skull, and we were able to extract DNA from her teeth. And her skull is that of what we call the Paleo-Americans. They're very distinct from modern Native Americans. They have a very different facial structure. Their faces, rather than it being large and broad, tend to be small and relatively narrow, short. Their eyes are much wider set. Their heads are longer. Their faces project forward. And whereas Native Americans have relatively round skulls, flat faces, and so forth. So they're very distinct. And the idea that some anthropologist had put forward, and an idea that I thought had merit, actually, at one point, was that these early people represent a separate migration, perhaps from a different place in the world than those who ultimately came in and became the Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But with the combination of DNA, and we had her DNA and found that it was an Asian form of DNA, or an Asian, from an Asian lineage, and the particular form, we call it haplogroup D1 of mitochondrial DNA, is only found in the Americas and is thought to have developed in Beringia before people entered the Americas, because it's widespread in the continents. So that put that facial structure in combination with Beringian DNA said that they came from the same place as the Native Americans did.
Okay. So it showed that someone with that skull structure, that facial structure, was a descendant of people who had come across the Beringian land bridge. But did it also prove that they were related to let's call them modern-day North American Indians, Native Americans, who have a different facial structure and a different skull structure? Did it prove that at the same time? Was that also?
What it does is support the idea that the Native Americans and Paleo-Americans, we call them, have a common heritage. That's really as much as we can say based on the evidence that we have.
Okay.
That they both trace their ancestry to Beringia.
So the nature of your study was really a DNA study on the skull that was found a few years earlier.
Well, right, it's reporting the confluence of information that we had been generating for the last few years.
That's right.
The scientific study only began in 2011.
We're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. James Chatters, who is a forensic anthropologist who led a study that was reported in the prestigious journal Science, a study of a skull that was found at the far back in a water-filled cave in Mexico a few years back that, when they did DNA analysis of it, proved that this skull belonged to an individual who was a descendant of people who had crossed across the Bering Sea land bridge, I don't know, 13,000-15,000 years ago, and that was something that where proof had been lacking up until then. So basically, it's the first time that a direct genetic link to what's called Beringia, that land bridge area, has been shown in an individual who clearly had the anatomical characteristics of a very early American. So in effect, it proves the land bridge theory, which is kind of a big deal in anthropology and archaeology. Jim, how are the oldest Aboriginal skulls physically different from those of modern Native Americans? You said their eyes are spread a little further apart. I mean, if you looked at them side by side, just two skulls, would you immediately see an obvious difference?
Right. They're quite different from each other. In fact, I've done that. I was once in a museum collection back when I was working on another skeleton known as Kennewick Man. And I just taken the new skull that I had to show someone for a second opinion, because it definitely did not have a Native American appearance. And while I was waiting for her assessment, I was looking around the room, and there was another skull that looked similar to it.
Hmm.
So I just sort of picked it out of the group. We ran a radiocarbon date on it, and it turned out to be the same age. So they are quite distinctive. And what's distinctive about them is the skull is longer and narrower. The face is narrower and typically shorter. They don't have the flaring cheekbones that Native Americans have.
Mm-hmm.
The palate is a different shape. It's sort of a parabola rather than a C shape, so it sort of widens as it goes backwards. The tooth form is more generalized, more like, say, Southeast Asians than Northeast Asians have. So there are a lot of differences between them, the wider set eyes, the lower eyes, and so forth. It's a big difference. And definitely if you set them side by side, you notice the distinction.
How many of these older-shaped skulls have been found?
There aren't that many individuals. There are only about 26 individuals for which we have skeletons or skulls that are reasonably intact. And of those that for which there are skulls, I think the number is less than 14.
Wow. And of course,
very small number.
And of course, the good thing about the skull that you studied from Mexico is that it was found deep down in cold water, probably below, at an anaerobic level, below where bacteria will live and work on it. So it was pretty much intact, I guess, and that was a good thing, I assume. But and maybe made it unique. I don't know. Where else have others been found out of the 14 or the small number of these that have been found?
There are actually several or three from the Valley of Mexico. These have come from very deep deposits in the Valley of Mexico during construction projects. Some are found in, this is just talking about the North American and Central American ones. There are some others in South America as well, but Valley of Mexico, Central Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, two in Washington, one in Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
Some in Minnesota.
Okay.
The ones that come quickly to mind.
Yeah, so they are spread through that path all the way up to Beringia, which is good, you know. But I'm curious about the big difference between those older skulls and the shape of modern Native American heads. Are there examples of skulls that have been found that are intermediate between these two types that show kind of an evolution or a transition from point A to point B?
It depends on where you are in the continent, but in Western North America, typically you see one and then you see the other. mean, they're very different from each other in a relatively short time. Hmm. But in the eastern, particularly eastern U.S., there seems to be sort of a clinal variation, sort of a gradual change from one to the next, as if that undergoes local evolution, whereas in the western U.S. there's a fairly quick replacement. And in the Pacific Northwest where I work, there's a cultural replacement that coincides with it.
Hmm.
So there is a secondary migration, I think, out of Beringia that accounts for that.
Oh, okay. Because I was thinking, as an anthropologist, I would assume you would expect to see kind of, you know, a transition or a spectrum, you know, an evolution from the one type to the other type. And if you had just the two distinct types, it would almost imply that they came at different times, at least, and maybe from different places. But if you do see some intermixing of cultures, I guess that means that they might have come at different times, different waves of people.
That's right. I think it's to be a difficult situation because we don't really have very many of those people in that intervening time. We see, until about 5,000 years ago, you don't see very many individuals at all.
Hmm.
There's one site in Florida with numerous individuals that were buried in a swamp from about 8,000 years ago. And that's a good group. But comparable to that in the West, there's nothing. An individual here, an individual there.
Yeah, we had Dr. Rachel Wentz on the show once in Florida talking about that site that you just mentioned. And I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it was a place where the Native Americans were buried there, and it became a construction site. And they were buried underwater and were essentially preserved in peat, more or less. And so they had intact brains inside their skulls. That was
right.
A fascinating thing. I mean, they were like, you know, people who had died 5 years ago rather than 10,000. But so talking about the DNA, I gather that the distinctive DNA marker you mentioned earlier that ties this skull to the people who lived in Beringia is more common today in native peoples who live in South America. At least I gather that from what I've read about it. Why is that, assuming it's true?
Well, one of the big controls of something like mitochondrial DNA, which the characteristics we're looking at in distinguishing these lineages are not, they're considered to be part of the non-coding part of the DNA. That is, they're not really doing anything. They're sort of random variation. And they undergo, rather than undergoing natural selection, since they have no advantage or disadvantage, they undergo genetic drift. So if you had a population that's coming through the Isthmus of Panama and only a few people come through, you may weed out a number of the different mitochondrial lineages, and so you get very different proportions than you would have in the original population in the subsequent populations that occupy the continent.
Okay. Do we know exactly what areas of East Asia these people came from? I think I remember reading once several years ago that they're closely related to people from like one area or even one village in Siberia, as I recall. I don't know if I remember that right or not, but is that clear cut that they come from a particular place? You mentioned earlier that different areas, but what's the story on that?
Well, that's something that I'm always arguing with my geneticist friends about, is they are always saying, well, this particular part of Asia has those mitochondrial markers today, that must be where the native populations of the Americas came from. But that ignores the intervening history and such factors as Genghis Khan and the expansion of the Mongols, not to mention many other historical events that moved people around.
Mm-hmm.
But we do, it is fairly clear that they came from East and Central Asia, but some of the genetics of the Native American populations are linked to a culture that spread from the Lake Baikal region of Asia, which is about almost exactly central in Asia, all the way to Western Europe. That accounts for about 30% of the genetic makeup of Native Americans.
Hmm.
And the other 70% is very similar to that of Chinese, Koreans, and other East Asians.
Yeah, I see.
So it's quite a widespread region that these folks derive their background from.
You are listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Jim Chatters, who is a forensic anthropologist and was the lead scientist on a study of a young girl's skull who died about 14,000 years ago in Mexico, and who the DNA in her molars, I think it was, led to proving the theory that that Native American peoples in North and South America came across a land bridge in the Bering Sea area from Asia. What was life like in that place called Beringia 15 to 20,000 years ago, Jim? What kind of animals did they hunt? I mean, was it cold all the time? Or, you know, what was life like? Do we have any idea what their general life was like? Were they nomadic people? Did they grow crops? Did they fish and hunt, you know, both or what?
Well, the thing about Beringia is we don't know very much about what was going on there. Most of the area that was habitable, the best part of the region actually, is sort of the southern rim of Beringia, which was a tremendous number of islands, a very, very convoluted coastline.
Hmm.
And that's now all underwater, so we can't study it.
Yeah, there you go.
But what we do know of the region is that there were, you know, mammoths and bison, horses, short-faced bears, dangerous cats and that sort of thing, occupying the region. But also, it looks like from what we see from the archaeological sites that have been excavated, the people were harvesting a lot of swans, birds,
mm-hmm.
In addition to hunting large animals. But they were certainly highly mobile. That is, they moved from place to place, very nomadic. It's quite possible that they typically rarely used the same place twice.
Mm-hmm.
It was no competition for the landscape, especially once they entered the Americas.
Yeah, it wasn't highly populated, that's for sure.
Nope.
Well, you know, I guess it would stand to reason, common sense-wise, that today's Inuit or Eskimo people are probably the closest direct descendants of the Beringians. Would that be true, valid?
It might be. They certainly are. They possess Beringian DNA markers also.
Okay.
So, yes, they probably are. They're, culturally, we see some of the Paleo-Eskimo, the earliest Eskimo material, the small tool tradition. It's called Arctic small tool tradition. It's very similar to what you see on the coast of Primorye, which is easternmost Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be, well, considered a part of Beringia as well.
Okay. So how long ago did the Beringian land bridge disappear? Was it fairly sudden that it, you know, the water rose up and covered it up, or was it a long, long period of time where it slowly disappeared?
In geologic time, it was quite fast. I think it was probably fairly rapid, perhaps even noticeable in an individual's lifetime.
Hmm.
But between most of it would have been gone between about 12 and 16,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It would have disappeared during that span of time.
So what happened? Did the ice age begin to end and the glaciers were melting and the water went back in the sea that had been trapped in ice above sea level? And so the,
exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. We had sea levels that were as much as, or actually more than 300 feet lower than they are today.
Good Lord.
Hmm. Big change. All the continental shelves, the eastern seaboard extended much farther out than it does today. Florida was about twice its size, in fact, maybe more than twice its size. The Yucatan Peninsula was nearly twice its size.
Wow. That's climate change.
That's
amazing.
Big climate change, yes.
Really?
We talk about worrying about 3-meter changes in sea level. Well, yeah. During the height of the glaciation, it was 120 meter difference at sea level.
Of course, they didn't have condos on the dune line either, but anyway.
No, you didn't have the population of Bangladesh as large as it is today. That would be potentially entirely drowned out by it. So it's much more severe now than it was back then.
So probably most of our listeners have heard of the other competing theories that the original Native Americans arrived by boat from Asia or Polynesia. I guess Thor Heyerdahl back in the 50s or so popularized that idea and did some analyses that were, you know, conjectural and questionable and so on, but interesting nevertheless. Are those competing theories still around, and is it possible maybe that both things happened, that people arrived from Asia by boat as well as over this land bridge?
Well, first, the Polynesians didn't occupy the Polynesian islands until after 2,000 years ago. So the earliest people of the Americas can't have come that way. There were certainly connections between Polynesia and the Americas. Sweet potato went from the coastal South America to Polynesia, and chickens got from the South Pacific to South America. We know those things were true, so there was a connection. But much earlier on, no, there would not have been such a crossing, but it's quite possible the people who first came here from Beringia came by boat around the coastline.
Hmm. So you don't think it's possible that anyone could have sailed any kind of craft 15,000 years ago or so across the whole Pacific?
Highly unlikely.
Okay. Fair enough. I would think it'd be a tough sail, no matter what. But
it'd be a tough sail, no matter what. Exactly. You'd have a hard time finding food out in the open ocean.
Well, Jim, we're just about out of time. We just have a minute or so left, but I've said a couple times that you're a forensic anthropologist, and so we understand forensics to be dealing with, at least on TV, with solving crimes and looking for evidence of crimes and so on. But just in a nutshell, what does a forensic anthropologist do as compared to other types of anthropologists?
Forensic anthropologists look at the evidence on a human skeleton to try and understand what happened to someone either during their life or at the end of their life, what brought about the end of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And really, by training, I'm an archaeologist and physical anthropologist, and you put those two together and you can be a forensic anthropologist because it requires the knowledge of both.
Okay, so kind of a related question. I think anthropologists study the history of ancient peoples and maybe even modern peoples of different cultures, but do archaeologists, kind of interested in the difference between anthropology and archaeology, do archaeologists only study ancient structures and tools and not bones, or how does that work, or do they overlap? You said you're both.
Archaeologists study the cultures and lives of people of the past, and one sort of subfield of archaeology is bioarchaeology. Really, that's more what I do than forensic anthropology these days. I don't do any crime-related work anymore.
Okay.
But archaeologists work with the past, the human past. It's the broadest way to say it.
Okay. And anthropologists don't necessarily work with the human past?
They can, right.
Okay.
Right. We're a subset in the United States. In other countries, it's a separate field, but in the United States, anthropology includes archaeology.
Okay, so archaeology is a subset of anthropology here.
Right.
Okay, got it. All right. Well, you can look up Beringia on Wikipedia.com, Beringia, and find out about the land bridge theory. How would they search for this particular story, Jim? Look up Naya.
Hoyo Negro, Hoyonegro.
Okay.
And then put Naya, N-A-I-A, after it.
N-A-I-A.
It's just Hoyo Negro is going to get you black holes in space, too.
Yeah, okay. All right. So Hoyo Negro Naya will get you probably the article in Science and the whole story about the background of what happened with the find down there. And there's actually a video on what I saw that's extremely interesting and beautiful.
Yeah, it won't get you the article in Science. We don't call her Naya in Science magazine.
Okay. All right, but you can get there from there anyway.
But you can get there from there, yeah. Like Hoyo Negro up and all the articles talk about the article in Science.
Well, Jim, I sure appreciate you being on with us on American Variety. It's been fascinating. Very interesting story. And I always like...
Good talking with you.
Yeah, you too. I always like stories about archaeology and anthropology. I don't know if it's just me, but I think maybe most people do like hearing about the ancient history of where we came from and what we used to be. And I want to thank all of you for listening. And I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.